against the heavy curtain. It's freezing back here in the little passage, up next to insulation and I-beams and away from the infrared heaters that hang over the courts. The plastic bucket is full of old, bald Wilson tennis balls and Pemulis's breakfast. There is, of course, an odor. Shock doesn't mind. He lightly strokes the sides of Pemulis's head as his mother had stroked his own big, sick head back in Philly. Placed at eye-level intervals in the tarp are little plastic windows, archer-slit views of each court from the cold backstage passage. Shocked sees John Wayne walk to the net post and flip his card as he and his opponent change sides. Even indoors, you change ends of the court after every odd-numbered game. No one knows why odd rather than even. Each PWTA court has, welded to its west net post, another smaller post with a double set of, like, flippable cards with big red numerals from 1 to 7. In umpless competition, you're supposed to flip your card appropriately at every change of sides to help the gallery follow the score in the set. A lot of junior players neglect to flip their cards. Wayne is always automatic and scrupulous in his accounts. Wayne's father is an asbestos miner, who at 43 is far and away the seniorest guy on his shift. He now wears triple-thick masks and is trying to hold on until John Wayne can start making serious dollars and take him away from all this. He has not seen his eldest son play since John Wayne's Quebecois and Canadian citizenships were revoked last year. Wayne's card is on 5. His opponent has yet to flip a card. Wayne never even sits down to take the 60 seconds he's allowed on each change of sides. His opponent, in his light blue, flare-collared shirt with Wilson and PWTA on the sleeves, says something not unfriendly as Wayne brushes past him by the post. Wayne doesn't respond one way or the other. He just goes back to the baseline farthest from Schacht's little tarp window and bounces a ball up and down in the air with the reticulate face of his stick as the Port Washington boy sits in his little canvas director's chair and towels the sweat off his arms, neither of which is large, and looks briefly up at the gallery behind the panel. The thing about Wayne is, he's all business. His face on court is blankly rigid, with the hypertonic masking of schizophrenics and Zen adepts. He tends to look straight ahead at all times. He is about as reserved as they come. His emotions emerge in terms of velocity, intelligence as strategic focus. His play, like his manner in general, seems to Schacht less alive than undead. Wayne tends to eat and study alone. He's sometimes seen with 2 or 3 expatriate ETA nooks, but when they're together, they all seem morose. It's wholly unclear to Schacht how Wayne feels about the U.S. or his citizenship status. He figures Wayne figures it doesn't much matter. He is destined for the show. He will be an all-business entertainer, citizen of the world, everywhere undead, endorsing juice drinks and liniment ointment. Pemulis has nothing left and is spasming dryly over the bucket. His covered Dunlop gut-strung sticks and gear tumble just past Schacht's in the passage. They are the last guys to get out on court. Schacht is to play number 3 singles on the 18's B team. Pemulis, number 6 B. They are undeniably tardy getting out there. Their opponents stand out on the baselines of courts 9 and 12, waiting for them to come out and warm up, jittery, stretching out the way you do when you've already stretched out, dribbling fresh, bright balls with their black Wilson wide-body sticks. The whole Port Washington Tennis Academy student body gets free and mandatory Wilson sticks under an administrative contract. Nothing personal, but no way would Schacht let an academy tell him what brand of stick to swing. He himself favors headmasters, which is regarded as bizarre and eccentric. The AMF head rep brings them out to him out of some cobwebby warehouse where they're kept since the line was discontinued during the Large Head Revolution many years back. Aluminum headmasters have small, perfectly round heads and a dull blue plastic brace in the V of the throat, and look less like weapons than toys. Coath and Axford are always kibitzing that they've seen a headmaster for sale at like a flea market or a garage sale someplace, and Schacht better get down there quick. Schacht, who's historically tight with Mario and with Lyle down in the weight room, where Schacht, since the knee and the Crohn's disease, likes to go even on off days to work off discomfort, and DeLint and Loach are always on him about not getting muscle-bound, has a way of just smiling and holding his tongue when he's kibitzed.
"Are you okay?"
Pamela says, "Blurg!" He wipes at his forehead in a gesture of completion and submits to being hauled to his feet and stands there on his own with his hands on his hips, slightly bent. Schacht straightens and pulls some wrinkles out of the bandage around the brace on his knee.
"Take maybe another second. Wayden's already way up."
Pemulus sniffs unpleasantly.
"How come this happens to me every time? This is not like me."
"Happens to some people is all."
"This hunched, spurting pale guy is not any me I ever recognize."
Schacht gathers gear.
"Some people, their nerves are in their stomachs. Sisney, Yardguard, Lord, you, stomach men."
"Teddy, brother, man, I'm never once hungover or a competitive thing. I take elaborate precautions, not so much as a whippet. I'm always in bed the night before by 2300, all pink-cheeked and clean."
As they pass the plastic window behind Court 2, Schacht sees Hal and Condensa try to pass his serve and volley guy with a baroque sideways slice down the backhand side and miss just wide. Hal's cards already flipped to 4. Schacht gives a little toodaloo wave that Hal can't see to acknowledge. Pemulus is in front of him as they go down the cold passage.
"Hal's way up too. Another victory for the forces of peace."
"Ugh, Jesus, I feel awful,"
Pemulus says.
"Things could be worse."
"Expand on that, will you?"
"This wasn't like that Atlanta stomach incident. We were enclosed here. No one saw. You saw that glass. The shtit and the lint, it's all a silent movie down here. Nobody heard thing one. Our guys will think we were back here butting heads to get enraged or something. Or we can tell them I got a cramp. That was a freebie in terms of stomach incidents."
Pemulus is a whole different person before competitive play.
"Ugh, I'm fucking inept."
Schacht laughs.
"You're one of the eptest people I know. Get off your own back."
"Never remember getting sick as a kid. Now it's like I make myself sick just from worrying about getting sick."
"Well, then there you go. Just don't think anything thoracic. Pretend you don't have a stomach."
"I have no stomach," Pemulus says.
His head stays still when he talks, at least, negotiating the passage. He carries 4 sticks, a rough white PWTA locker room towel, an empty ball can full of high chlorine Long Island water, nervously zipping and unzipping the top stick's cover. Schacht only ever carries 3 sticks. His don't have covers on them, except for Pemulus and Raider and Unwin, and a couple others who favor gut strings and really need protection. Nobody at Enfield uses racket covers. It's like an anti-fashion statement. People with covers make a point of telling you they're valid and for gut. A similar point of careful non-pride is never having their shirts tucked in. Ortho Stice used to drill and cut off black jeans until Shtit had Tony Nwangi go over and scream at him about it. Each academy has its own style, or anti-style. The PWTA people, more or less a de facto subsidiary of Wilson, have unnecessary light blue Wilson covers on all their courtside synthetic strung sticks, and big red W's stenciled on their Wilson synth gut strings. You have to let your company of choice spray paint their logo on your strings if you want to be on their free list for sticks, is the universal junior deal. Schacht's orange Gamma 9 synthetic strings have AMF Head Inc.'s weird Taoist paraboloid logo sprayed on them. Pemulus isn't on Dunlop's free list, but gets the ETA stringer to put Dunlop's dot and circumflex trademark on all his Stick's strings as a kind of touchingly insecure gesture, in Schacht's opinion.
88.
I played your guy in Tampa 2 years ago, Pemulus says, sidestepping one of the old discolored drill balls that always litter passages behind indoor tarps.
Name escapes.
Le something, says Schacht. Yet another nook. One of those names that start with Le.
Mario Incandenza, in a pair of little Aldern Talatkelpsa's ETA drill sweats, is lurching, noiselessly, some 10 meters behind them in the passage. His police lock up and head uncamered.
He's framing Schacht's back in a three-cornered box with his thumbs and long fingers, simulating the view through a lens.
Mario's been authorized to travel with the squads to the Whataburger Invitational for final footage for his short and upbeat annual documentary. Brief testimonials and lighthearted moments and behind-the-scenes shots and emotional moments on court, etc., that every year gets distributed to ETA alumni and patrons and guests at the pre-Thanksgiving fundraising exhibition and formal fete. Mario is wondering how you could get enough light back here in the tarp tunnel to film a tense, cold, pre-match gladiatorial march behind an indoor tarp, carrying tennis rackets in your arms like an obscene bouquet, without sacrificing the dim and diffuse and kind of gladiatorially doomed quality figures in the dim passage have. After Pemulus has mysteriously won, he'll tell Mario maybe a Merino 350 with a diffusion filter on some kind of overhead cable you could winch along behind the figures at about twice the focal length, or else use fast film and station the Merino at the tunnel's very start and let the figures' backs gradually recede into a kind of doomed mist of low exposure.
I remember your guy as being one big forehand. Nothing but slice off the back.
His vaps never varies.
If you, kick the serve over to the back end, he'll slice it short. You can come in behind it at, like, will.
Worry about your own guy, Schacht says.
Your guy's got zero imagination, and you've got an empty expanse where your stomach ought to be, remember?
I am a man with no stomach.
They emerge through flaps in the tarp with hands upraised in slight apology to their opponents, walk out onto the warmer courts, the slow, green, eraserish footing of indoor composite. Their ears dilate into all the sounds in the larger space. Gasps, and thwops, and pocks, and sneakers squeaks. Pemulus's court is almost down in female territory. Courts 13 to 24 are girls, 18s A and B, all bobbing ponytails and two-handed backhands and high-pitched grunts that if girls could only hear what their own grunts sounded like, they'd cut it out. Pemulus can't tell whether the very muffled applause way down up behind the gallery panel is sardonic applause at his finally appearing after several minutes of vomiting, or is sincerely for K.D. Coyle on court 3, who's just smashed a sucker lob so hard it's bounced up and racked 3's tray of hanging lights. Except for some rubber in his legs, Pemulus feels stomachless and tentatively okay. This match is an all-out must-win for him in terms of the Whataburger. The infra-lit courts are warm and soft. The heaters bolted into both walls above the tarp's upper hem are the deep warm red of little square suns. The Port Washington players all wear matching socks and shorts and tucked-in shirts. They look sharp, but effete. A mannequinish aspect to them. Most of the higher-ranked ETA students are free to sign on with different companies for no fees but free gear. Coyle is Prince and Reebok, as is Trevor Axford. John Wayne is Dunlop and Adidas. Schacht is Headmaster Sticks, but his own clothes and knee supports. Ortho Stice is Wilson and All Black Fila.
Keith Freer is Fox Sticks, and both Adidas and Reebok until one of the two companies' NNE reps catches on. Trolch is Spalding, and damn lucky to get that. Howlin' Condensa is Dunlop, and lightweight Nike high tops, and an air stirrup brace for the Dickie ankle. Shaw is Kennex Sticks and clothes from Tachani's Big and Tall line. Pemulus's entrepreneurial vim has earned him complete freedom of choice and expense. Though he's barred by DeLint and Nwangi from shirts that mention the Sinn Féin or that extol Alston, Massachusetts in any way in competition. Before going back to the baseline and warming up ground strokes, Schacht likes to take a little time courtside futzing around, hitting his head's frames against strings and listening for the pitch of best tension, arranging his towel on the back of his chair, making sure his cards aren't still flipped from some previous match, etc. And then, he prefers to sort of snuffle around his baseline for a bit, checking for dust bunnies of ball fuzz and little divots or ridges from cold weather heave, adjusting the brace on his ruined knee, putting his thick arms out, cruciform, and pulling them way back to stretch out the old pecs and cuffs. His opponent waits patiently, twirling his polybutylene stick. And when they finally start to hit around, the guy's expression is pleasant. Schacht always prefers a pleasant match, one way or the other. He really doesn't care all that much whether he wins anymore, since first the Crohn's and then the knee at 16. He'd probably now describe his desire to win as a preference, nothing more. What's singular is that his tennis seems to have improved slightly in the 2 years since he stopped really caring. It's like his hard, flat game stopped having any purpose beyond itself and started feeding on itself and got fuller, looser, its edges less jagged, though everybody else has been improving too, even faster, and Schacht's rank has been steadily declining since 16, and the staff has stopped talking even about a top college ride. Stitz warmed to him, though, since the knee and the loss of any urge beyond the play itself, and treats Schacht now almost more like a peer than an experimental subject with something at stake. Schacht is already in his heart committed to a dental career, and he even interns twice a week for a root specialist over at the National Craniofacial Pain Foundation in East Enfield when not touring. It strikes Schacht as odd that Pemulus makes such a big deal of stopping all substances the day before competitive play, but never connects the neurasthenic stomach to any kind of withdrawal or dependence. He'd never say this to Pemulus unless Pemulus asked him directly, but Schacht suspects Pemulus is physically dream-dependent, preluding, or attenuate, or something. It's not his business. Schacht's supposedly French-Canadian guy is as broad as Schacht, but shorter, his face dark, and with a kind of Eskimoid structure to it. At 18, his hairline recessed in the sort of way where you just know the kid's already got hair on his back. And he warms up with crazy spins, Mooney top off a Western forehand and weird inside-out shit off a one-hand back. His knees dipping oddly whenever he makes contact, and his follow-through full of the dancerly flourishes that characterize a case of nerves. A nervous spin artist can be eaten more or less for lunch if you hit as hard as Schacht does. And what Pemulus said is true. The guy's backhand is always sliced and lands shallow. Schacht looks over at Pemulus's guy, a grunter with a moody profile and the storky look of recent puberty. Pemulus is looking oddly sanguine and confident after a couple minutes futzing with the cans of water, rinsing out the oral cavity and so on. Pemulus is maybe going to win too, despite himself. Schacht figures he can run in and get one of the 12-year-olds he big buddies to go back into the passage and empty Pemulus's bucket on the sly before anybody coming off court sees it. Evidence of nervous incapacity of any kind gets noted and logged at ETA, and Schacht's observed Pemulus having some kind of vested emotional interest in attending the Whataburger Invitational over Thanksgiving. He thought Mario's lurking around in the cold passage, scratching his poor big head over technical lighting problems was kind of funny. There will be no lungs, or tarps, or dim passages at the Whataburger. The Tucson tournament is outside. and Tucson cruised around 40 degrees Celsius even in November. And the sun there was a retinal horror show on overheads and serves. Though Schacht buys quarterly urine like the rest of them, it seems to Pemulus that Schacht ingests the occasional chemical that way grown-ups who sometimes forget to finish their cocktails drink liquor, to make a tense but fundamentally okay interior life, interestingly different but no more, no element of relief, a kind of tourism. And Schacht doesn't even have to worry about obsessive training, like Ink or Stice, or get sick so often from the physical stress of constant dreams, like Trolch, or suffer from thinly disguised psychological fallout like Ink or Struck or Pemulus himself. The way Pemulus and Trolch and Struck and Axford ingest substances and recover from substances and have a whole jargony argot based around various substances gives Schacht the creeps a bit. But since the knee injury broke and remade him at 16, he's learned to go his own interior way and let others go theirs. Like most very large men, he's getting comfortable early with the fact that his place in the world is very small, and his real impact on other persons even smaller. Which is a big reason he can sometimes forget to finish his portion of a given substance. So interested does he become in the way he's already started to feel. He's one of these people who don't need much, much less, much more. Schacht and his opponent warm up their ground strokes with the fluid economy of years of warming up ground strokes. They take turns feeding each other some volleys at net, and then each take a couple up lobs, hitting loose, easy overheads, slowly adjusting the idle from half speed to three-quarter speed. The knee feels fundamentally all right, springy. Slow indoor composite surfaces do not like Schacht's hard flat game, but they are kind to the knee, which after some days outside on hard cement swells to about the size of a volleyball. Schacht feels blandly happy down here on 9, playing in private, way down past the gallery's panel. There is a nourishing sense of pregnable space in a big indoor club that you never get playing outside. Especially playing outside in the cold, when the balls feel hard and sullen and come off the stick's strung face with an echoless ping. Here everything cracks and booms. The grunts and shoe squeaks and booming pocks of impact and curses unfolding across the white-on-green plain and echoing off each tarp. Soon they'll all go inside for the winter. Schitt will yield and let them inflate the ETA lung over the 16 center courts. It's like a barn raising, Inflation Day. It's communal and fun. And they'll take down the central fences and outdoor night lamps and unbolt all the posts into sections and stack them and store them. And the Testar and ATH SCME guys will come up in vans smoking cigarettes and squinting with weary expertise at tubes of plans in Draftsman Blue. And there'll be one and sometimes two ATH SCME helicopters with slings and grappling hooks for the lung's dome and nacelle. And Schitt and DeLint will let the younger ETAs get the infrared indoor heaters out of the same corrugated shed the disassembled fences and lamps will go in. Leafcutter ant or Korean-like armies of 14 and 16-year-olds carrying sections and heaters and Gore-Tex swatches and long halolithiated bulbs. While the 18s get to sit on canvas chairs and kibbutz because they did their leafcutter lung-raising bits at 13 to 16 already. Two Testar guys will supervise Otis P. Lord and all this year's conspicuous tech wonks in mounting the heaters and stringing the lights and running coaxial shunts with ceramic jacks between the pump room's main breaker and the Sunstrand grid and booting up the circulation fans and pneumatic hoists. That'll raise the lung to the inflated shape of a distended igloo, 16 quarts in 4 rows of 4, enclosed and warmed by nothing but fibrous Gore-Tex and AC current and an enormous ATH SCME exhaust flow effectuator that an ATH SCME crew in one of the ATH SCME helicopters will bring in a sling and cable, and mount and secure on the lung's nipply nacelle at the top of the inflating dome.
On that first night after inflation, traditionally the fourth Monday of November, all the upper-class 18s so inclined will crank up the infrareds and get high and eat low-lipid microwave pizza and play all night, sweating magnificently, sheltered for the winter atop Enfield's level-headed hill. Schacht stands back in the deuce court and lets his guy warm up his serves. Oddly flat and low margin for a nervous touch artist. Schacht bloops each return up with severe backspin so the balls will roll back to him and he can serve them back to this guy, also warming up. The warm-up routine has become automatic and requires no attention. Way up on number one, Schacht sees John Wayne just plaster a backhand cross-court. Wayne hits it so hard a little mushroom cloud of green fuzz hangs in the air where ball had met strings. Their cards were too far to read in the sour apple light, but you could tell by the way Port Washington's best boy walked back to the baseline to take the next serve that his ass had already been presented to him. In a lot of junior matches, everything past the fourth game or so is kind of a formality. Both players tend to know the overall score by then, the big picture. They'll have decided who's going to lose. Competitive tennis is largely mental, once you're at a certain plateau of skill and conditioning. Stitted say spiritual instead of mental, but as far as Schacht can see, it's the same thing. As Schacht sees it, Stitt's philosophical stance is that to win enough of the time to be considered successful, you have to both care a great deal about it and also not care about it at all.
89.
Schacht does not care enough, probably, anymore, and has met his gradual displacement from ETA's A singles squad with an equanimity some ETAs thought was spiritual, and others regarded as the surest sign of dicklessness and burnout. Only one or two people have ever used the word brave in connection with Schacht's radical reconfiguration after the things with the Crohn's disease and knee. Howland Condenza, who's probably as asymmetrically hobbled on the care-too-much side as Schacht is on the not-enough, privately puts Schacht's laissez-faire down to some interior decline, some doom-gray surrender of his childhood's promise to adult-gray mediocrity, and fears it. But since Schacht is an old friend and a dependable designated driver, and has actually gotten pleasanter to be around since the knee, which Hal prays fervently that the ankle won't start being the size of a volleyball itself at the end of each outdoor day, Hal, in a weird and deeper internal way, almost, somehow, admires and envies the fact that Schacht's stoically committed himself to the oral professions and stopped dreaming of getting to the show after graduation. An air of something other than failure about Schacht's not caring enough, something you can't quite define, the way you can't quite remember a word that you know inside. Hal can't quite feel the contempt for Teddy Schacht's competitive slide. That would be a pretty much natural contempt in one who cared so dreadfully, secretly much. And so the two of them tend to settle for not talking about it. Just as Schacht cheerfully, wordlessly, drives the tow truck on occasions, when the rest of the crew are so incapacitated they have to hold one eye closed even to see an undoubled road, and consents, without protest, to pay retail for clean quarterly urine, and doesn't say a word about Hal's devolution from occasional tourist to subterranean compulsive, substance-wise, with his pump room visits and Visine, even though Schacht deep down believes that the substance compulsion's strange apparent contribution to Hal's irrumpant explosion up the rankings has got to be a temporary thing. But there's like a psychic credit card bill for Hal in the mail somewhere coming, and is sad for him in advance about whatever's surely got to give, eventually. Though it won't be the boards, Hal will murder his boards, and Schacht may well be among those jockeying to sit near him. He'd be the first to admit. On two, Hal now kicks a second serve to the ad court with so much left-handed top on it that it almost kicks up over Port Washington's number two guy's head. It's clearly
carnage up there on show courts 1 and 2.
Dr. Tavis will be irrepressible.
The gallery is barely even applauding Wayne and in Cadenza anymore. At a certain point, it becomes like Romans applauding lions. All the coaches and staff and PWTA parents and civilians in the overhead gallery wear tennis outfits, the high white socks and tucked-in shirts of people who do not really play. Schacht and his man play. Both Pat Montesian and Gately's AA sponsor like to remind Gately how this new resident, Jeffrey Day, could end up being an invaluable teacher of patience and tolerance for him, Gately, as Ennett House staff.
"So then at 46 years of age, I came here to learn to live by cliches," is what Day says to Charlotte Treat, right after Randy Lentz asked what time it was, again, at 08:25. "To turn my life and will over to the care of cliches. One day at a time. Easy does it. First things first. Courage is fear that has said its prayers. Ask for help. Thy will, not mine, be done. It works if you work it. Grow or go. Keep coming back."
Poor old Charlotte Treat, needlepointing primly beside him on the old vinyl couch that just came from Goodwill, purses her lips. "You need to ask for some gratitude."
"Oh, no. But the point is, I've already been fortunate enough to receive gratitude."
Day crosses one leg over the other in a way that inclines his whole little soft body toward her.
"For which, believe you me, I'm grateful. I cultivate gratitude. That's part of the system of cliches I'm here to live by. An attitude of gratitude. A grateful drunk will never drink."
I know the actual cliche is a grateful heart will never drink, but since organs can't properly be said to imbibe, I'm still afflicted with just enough self-will to decline to live by utter non sequiturs, as opposed to just good old cliches. I'm taking the liberty of light amendment. He gives with this a look like butter wouldn't melt.
Albeit, grateful amendment, of course.
Charlotte Treat looks over to Gately for some sort of help or staff enforcement of dogma. The poor bitch is clueless. All of them are clueless still. Gately reminds himself that he too is probably mostly still clueless, still, even after all these hundreds of days. "I didn't know that I didn't know" is another of the slogans that looks so shallow for a while and then all of a sudden drops off and deepens like the lobster waters off the North Shore. As Gately fidgets his way through daily AM meditation, he always tries to remind himself daily that this is all an Ennett House residency is supposed to do. Buy these poor yutzes some time. Some thin pie slice of abstinent time till they can start to get a whiff of what's true and deep, almost magic, under the shallow surface of what they're trying to do.
"I cultivated assiduously. I do special gratitude exercises at night up there in the room. Gratitude ups, you could call them. Ask Randy over there if I don't do them like clockwork. Diligently. Sedulously."
"Well, it's true is all," Treat sniffs, "about gratitude."
Everybody else except Gately, lying on the old other couch opposite them, is ignoring this exchange, watching an old interlaced cartridge whose tracking is a little messed up, so that staticky stripes eat at the screen's pictures bottom and top. Day is not done talking. Pat M. encourages newer staff to think of residents they'd like to bludgeon to death as valuable teachers of patience, tolerance, self-discipline, restraint. Day is not done talking.
"One of the exercises is being grateful that life is so much easier now. I used to think in long compound sentences with subordinate clauses and even the odd polysyllable. Now I find I needn't. Now I live by the dictates of macrame samplers ordered from the back page ad of an old Reader's Digest
or Saturday Evening Post. Easy does it. Remember to remember. But for the grace of capital G God. Turn it over. Terse, hard-boiled, monosyllabic, good old Norman Rockwell, Paul Harvey wisdom.
I walk around with my arms straight out in front of me and recite these cliches in a monotone.
No inflection necessary. Could that be one? Could that be added to the cliche pool? No inflection necessary. Too many syllables, probably.
Randy Lentz says, I ain't got time for this shit. Poor old Charlotte Treat, all of 9 weeks clean, is trying to look primmer and primmer. She looks again over to Gately, lying on his back, taking up the living room's whole other sofa. One sneaker up on the sofa's square, frayed fabric arm thing, his eyes almost closed. Only staff get to lie on the couches. Denial, Charlotte finally says, is not a river in Egypt.
How's about the both of you shut the fuck up, says Emil Minty.
Jeffrey, not Jeff, Jeffrey Day, has been at Ennett House 6 days. He came from Roxbury's infamous Dimmock detox, where he was the only white person, which Gately Betts must have been broadening for him. Day has a squished, blank, smeared, flat face, one requiring, like, great self-effort to like, and eyes that are just starting to lose the nictitated glaze of early sobriety. Day is a newcomer, and a wreck. A red wine and quaalude man who finally nodded out in late October and put his sob through the window of a Malden sporting goods store, and then got out and proceeded to browse until the finest came and got him. Who taught something horseshit sounding like social historicity or historical sociality at some junior college up the expressway in Medford, and came in saying on his intake he also manned the helm of a scholarly quarterly. Word for word, the house manager had said, manned the helm and scholarly. His intake estimated that Day's been in and out of a blackout for most of the last several years, and his wiring is still, as they say, a bit frayed. His detox at Dimmock, where they barely have the resources to give you a Librium if you start to DT, must have been just real grim, because Jeffrey D. alleges it never happened. Now his story is he just strolled into Ennett House on a lark one day from his home 10 clicks away in Malden, and found the place too hilariously egregulous to want to ever leave. It's the newcomers with some education that are the worst, according to Gene M. They identify their whole selves with their head, and the disease makes its command headquarters in the head.
90.
Day wears chinos of indeterminate hue, brown socks with black shoes, and shirts that Pat Montesian had described in the intake as Eastern European-type Hawaiian shirts. Day's now on the vinyl couch with Charlotte Treat after breakfast in the Ennett House living room, with a few of the other residents that either aren't working or don't have to be at work early, and with Gately, who'd pulled an all-night dream duty shift out in the front office till 0400, then got temp relieved by Jeanette Fultz, so we could go to work janitoring down at the Shattuck shelter until 0700, then came and hauled ass back up here and took back over so that Jeanette could go off to her N.A. thing with a bunch of N.A. people in what looked like a dune buggy, if the dunes in question were in hell, and is now, Gately, trying to unclench and center himself inside by tracing the cracks in the paint of the living room ceiling with his eyes. Gately often feels a terrible sense of loss, narcotics-wise, in the A.M. still, even after this long clean. His sponsor over at the White Flag Group says some people never get over the loss of what they thought was their one true best friend and lover. They just have to pray daily for acceptance and the brass danglers to move forward through the grief and loss, to wait for time to harden the scab. The sponsor, ferocious Francis G., doesn't give Gately one iota of shit for feeling some negative feelings about it. On the contrary, he commends Gately for his candor in breaking down and crying like a baby and telling him about it early 1 a.m. over the payphone,
the sense of loss. It's a myth no one misses it. Their particular substance? Shit. You wouldn't need help if you didn't miss it. You just have to ask for help and, like, turn it over, the loss and pain, to keep coming, show up, pray, ask for help. Gately rubs his eye. Simple advice like this does seem like a lot of cliches. Bay's right about how it seems. Yes, and if Jeffrey Day keeps on steering by the way things seem to him, then he's a dead man for sure. Gately's already watched dozens come through here and leave early and go back out there and then go to jail or die. If Day ever gets lucky and breaks down, finally, and comes to the front office at night to scream that he can't take it anymore and clutch at Gately's pant cuff and blubber and beg for help at any cost, Gately'll get to tell Day the thing is that the cliché directives are a lot more deep and hard to actually do, to try and live by, instead of just say. But he'll only get to say it if Day comes and asks. Personally, Gately gives Jeffrey D. like a month at the outside before he's back tipping his hat to parking meters. Except who is Gately to judge who'll end up getting the gift of the program versus who won't, he needs to remember. He tries to feel like Day is teaching him patience and tolerance. It takes great patience and tolerance not to want to punt the soft little guy out into the Commonwealth Avenue ravine and open up his bunk to somebody that really desperately wants it, the gift. Except who is Gately to think he can know who wants it and who doesn't deep down? Gately's arm is behind his head, up against the sofa's other arm. The old DEC viewer is on to something violent and color-enhanced Gately neither sees nor hears. It was part of his gifts as a burglar. He can sort of turn his attention on and off like a light. Even when he was a resident here, he'd have this prescient housebreaker's ability to screen input, to do sensory triage. It was one reason he'd even been able to stick out his 9 residential months here with 21 other newly detoxed housebreakers, hoods, whores, fired execs, Avon ladies, subway musicians, beer-bloated construction workers, vagrants, indignant car salesmen, bulimic trauma mamas, bunco artists, mincing pillow biters, North End hard guys, pimply kids with electric nose rings, denial-ridden housewives, and etc. All jonesing and head-gaming and mocus and grieving and basically whacked out and producing non-stopping output 24/7/365. At some point in here, Day's saying, "So bring on the lobotomist. Bring him on, I say." Except Gately's own counselor, when he was a resident here, Eugenio Martinez, one of the volunteer alumni counselors, a one-eared, former boiler room bunco man, and now a cellular phone retailer who'd hooked up with the house under the original founder, guy that didn't even use his first name, and had about 10 years clean, Gene M. did. Eugenio'd lovingly confronted Gately early on about his special burglar's selective attention and about how it could be dangerous because how can you be sure it's you doing the screening and not the spider? Gene called the disease the spider and talked about feeding the spider versus starving the spider and so on and so forth. Eugenio M. had called Gately into the house manager's back office and said, "What if Don's screening input turned out to be feeding the old spider? And what about an experimental unscreening of input for a while?" Gately had said he'd do his best to try and had come back out and tried to watch a spot dissum of the Celtics while two resident pillow biters from the Fenway were having this involved conversation about some third fag having to go in and get the skeleton of some kind of fucking rodent removed from inside their butthole.
91.
The unscreening experiment had lasted half an hour.
This was right before Gately got his 90-day chip and wasn't exactly wrapped real tight or real tolerant still.
And at house this year is nothing like the freak show it was when Gately went through. Gately has been completely substance-free for 421 days. Today. Ms. Charlotte Treat, with a carefully made-up ruined face,
is watching the viewer's striped shot cartridge while she needlepoints something. Conversation between her and Jeffrey D. has mercifully petered out. Day is scanning the room for somebody else to engage and piss off so he can prove to himself he doesn't fit in here and stay separated off, isolated inside himself, and maybe get them so pissed off there's a beef and he gets bounced out, Day, and it won't be his fault. You can almost hear his disease chewing away inside his head, feeding. Emil Minty, Randy Lentz, and Bruce Green are also in the room, sprawled in spring-shot chairs, lighting one gasper off the end of the last, their postures, the don't-fuck-with-me slouch of the streets, that here makes their body's texture somehow hard to distinguish from that of the chairs. Neil Gunther is sitting at the long table in the doorless dining room that opens out right off the old DEC fold-out TP's pine stand, whitening under her nails, with a manicure pencil amid the remains of something she's eaten that involved serious syrup. Bert F. Smith is also in there, way down by himself at the table's far end, trying to saw at a waffle with a knife and fork attached to the stumps of his wrists with Velcro bands. A long time ago former DMV driver's license examiner, Bert F. Smith is 45 and looks 70. Has almost all white hair that's waxy and yellow from close order smoke, and finally got into Ennett House last month after 9 months stuck in the Cambridge City shelter. Bert F. Smith's story is, he's making his, like, 50th odd stab at sobriety in AA. Once devoutly RC, Bert F.S. has potentially lethal trouble with faith in a loving God, ever since the RC Church apparently granted his wife an annulment in, like, BS 99 after 15 years of marriage. Then for several years a rooming house drunk, which on Gately's view is about like one step up from a homeless person type drunk. Bert F.S. got mugged and beaten half to death in Cambridge on Xmas Eve of last year, and left there to, like, freeze there, in an alley, in a storm, and ended up losing his hands and feet. Dooney Glenn's been observed telling Bert F.S. things like that there's some new guy coming into the disabled room off Pat's office with Bert F.S., who's without not only hands and feet, but arms and legs and even a head, and who communicates by farting in Morse code. This sally earned Glenn 3 days full house restriction and a week's extra chore for what Jeanette Foltz described in the log as exive cruelty. There is a vague intestinal moaning in Gately's right side. Watching Bert F. Smith smoke a Benson and Hedges by holding it between his stumps, with his elbows out like a guy with pruning shears, is an adventure in fucking pathos as far as Gately's concerned. And Jeffrey Day cracks wise about there but for grace. And forget about what it's like trying to watch Bert F. Smith try and light a match. Gately, who's been on live-in staff here 4 months now, believes Charlotte Treat's devotion to needlepoint is suspect. All those needles, in and out of all that thin, sterile white cotton, stretched drum-tight in its round frame. The needle makes a kind of thud and squeak when it goes into the cloth. It's not much like the soundless pop and slide of real cook and shoot, but still, she takes such great care. Gately wonders what color he'd call the ceiling if forced to cull it a color. It's not white, and it's not gray. The brown-yellow tones are from high tar gaspers. A pall hangs up near the ceiling, even this early in the new sober day. Some of the drunks and track jockeys stay up most of the night, joggling their feet and chain-smoking, even though there's no cartridges or music allowed after 100 hours. He has that odd house staffer's knack, Gately, already after 4 months, of seeing everything in both living and dining rooms without really looking. Emil Minty, a hardcore smack addict punk here for reasons nobody can quite yet pin down, is in an old mustard-colored easy chair with his combat boots up on one of the standing ashtrays, which is tilting not quite enough for Gately to tell him to watch out, please. Minty's orange mohawk and the shaved skull around it are starting to grow out brown, which is just not a pleasant sight in the morning at all. The other ashtray on the floor by his chair is full of the ragged little new moons of bitten nails, which has got to mean that the Hester tea that he'd ordered to bed at 0230 was right back down here in the chair, going at her nails again the second Gately left to mop shit at the shelter. When he's up all night, Gately's stomach gets all tight and acidy from either all the coffee maybe or just staying up. Minty's been on the streets since he was like 16, Gately can tell. He's got that sooty complexion homeless guys get where the soot has insinuated itself into the dermal layer and thickened, making Minty look somehow upholstered. And the big-armed driver from Leisure Time Ice, the quiet kid, green, a garbage head, all-substance type kid, maybe 21, face very slightly smunched in on one side, wears sleeveless khaki shirts, and had lived in a trailer in that apocalyptic Enfield trailer park out near the Alston Spur. Gately likes Green because he seems to have got sense enough to keep his map shut when he's got nothing important to say, which is basically all the time. The tattoo on the kid's right tricep is a spear-pierced heart over the hideous name Mildred Bonk, who, Bruce G. told him, was a ray of living light and a dead ringer for the late lead singer of The Fiends in Human Shape and his dead heart's one love ever, and who took their daughter and left him this summer for some guy that told her he ranched fucking longhorn cows east of Atlantic City, New Jersey. He's got, even by Ennett House standards, major league sleep trouble, Green. And he and Gately play cribbage sometimes in the wee dead hours, a game Gately picked up in jail. Bert F. Smith is now hunched in a meaty coughing fit, his elbows out and his forehead purple. No sign of Hester Thrail, nail-biter, and something Pat calls borderline. Gately can see everything without moving or moving his head or either eye. Also in here is Randy Lentz, who, Lentz is, a small-time organic Coke dealer who wears sport coats rolled up over his parlor-tanned forearms and is always checking his pulse on the inside of his wrists. It's come out that Lentz is of keen interest to both sides of the law because this past May, he'd apparently, all of a sudden, lost all control and holed up all of a sudden in a Charlestown motel and freebased most of a whole 100 grams. He'd been fronted by a suspiciously trusting Brazilian in what Lentz didn't know was supposed to have been a DEA sting operation in the South End. Having screwed both sides in what Gately secretly views as a delicious fuck-up, Randy Lentz has, since May, been the most wanted he's probably ever been. He is seedily handsome in the way of pimps and low-level coke dealers, muscular in the MP-ish way that certain guys' muscles look muscular, but can't really lift anything, with complexly gelled hair and the little bird-like head movements of the deeply vain. One forearm's hair has a little hairless patch, which Gately knows well, spells knife owner. And if there's one thing Gately's never been able to stomach, it's a knife owner. Little swaggery guys that always queer a square beef and come up off the ground with a knife where you have to get cut to take it away from them. Lens is teaching Gately reserved politeness to people you pretty much want to beat up on sight. It's pretty obvious to everybody except Pat Montesian, whose odd gullibility in the presence of human sludge, though, Gately needs to try to remember, had been one of the reasons why he himself had got into Ennett House originally. Obvious that Lentz is here mostly just a hideout. He rarely leaves the house except under compulsion, avoids windows, and travels to the nightly required AA-NA meetings in a disguise that makes him look like Cesar Romero after a terrible accident. And then, he always wants to walk back to the house solo afterward, which is not encouraged. Lance is now seated low in the northeasternmost corner of an old fake velour love seat he's jammed in the northeasternmost corner of the living room. Randy Lentz has a strange compulsive need to be north of everything, and possibly even northeast of everything, and Gately has no clue what it's about, but observes Lentz's position routinely for his own interest and files. Lentz's leg, like Ken Urdetti's leg, never stops joggling. Day claims it joggles even worse in sleep. Another gurgle and abdominal chug from Don G lying there. Charlotte Treat has violently red hair, as in hair the color of like a red crayon. The reason she doesn't have to work an outside menial job is she's got some strain of the virus, or like HIV. Former prostitute, reformed. Why do prostitutes, when they get straight, always try and get so prim? It's like long-repressed librarian ambitions come flooding out. Charlotte T. has a cut-rate whore's hard, half-pretty face. Her eyes lassoed with shadow around all four lids. Her also with a case of dermal layer sooty complexion. The riveting thing about Treat is how her cheeks are deeply pitted in these deep trenches that she packs with foundation and tries to cover over with blush, which along with the hair gives her the look of a mean clown. The ghastly wounds in her cheeks look for all the world like somebody got at her with a wood-burning kit at some point in her career path. Gately would rather not know. Don Gately is almost 29 and sober and just huge, lying there gurgling and inert with a fluttery-eyed smile. One shoulder blade and buttock pooch out over the side of a sofa that sags like a hammock. Gately looks less built than poured, the smooth immovability of an Easter Island statue. It would be nice if intimidating size wasn't one of the major factors in a male alumni getting offered the male live-in staff job here. But there you go. Don G has a massive square head, made squarer looking by the Prince Valiantish haircut he tries to maintain himself in the mirror to save money. Room and board aside, plus the opportunity for service, he makes very little as an Ennett House staffer, and is paying off restitution schedules in three different district courts. He has the fluttery, white-eyed smile now of someone who's holding himself just over the level of doze. Pat Montesian is due in at 0900, and Don G can't go to bed until she arrives because the house manager has driven Jennifer Belbin to a court appearance downtown, and he's the only staffer here. Fultz, the female live-in staffer, is at a Narcotics Anonymous convention in Hartford for the long Interdependence Day weekend. Gately personally is not hot on N.A. So many relapses and unhumble returns, so many war stories told with non-disguised bullshit pride, so little emphasis on service or serious message, all these people in leather and metal, preening. Rooms full of Randy Lentzes, all hugging each other, pretending they don't miss the substance. Rampant newcomer fucking. There's a difference between abstinence versus recovery. Gately knows. Except, of course, who's Gately to judge what works for who? He just knows what seems like it works for him today. AA's tough Enfield Brighton love, the White Flag group. Old guys with suspended bellies and white crew cuts and geologic amounts of sober time. The crocodiles that'll take your big square head off if they sense you're getting complacent or chasing tail or forgetting that your life still hangs in the balance every fucking day. White Flag newcomers so crazed and sick they can't sit and have to pace at the meeting's rear like Gately when he first came. Retired old kindergarten teachers and polyresin slacks and a pince-nez, who bake cookies for the weekly meeting and relate from behind the podium how they used to blow bartenders at closing for just two more fingers in a paper cup to take home against the morning's needled light. Gately, albeit an oral narcotics man from way back, has committed himself to AA. He drank his fair share too, he figures, after all. Executive Director Pat Montesian is due in at 0900, and has application interviews with three people, two female and one male, who better be showing up soon, and Gately will answer the door when they don't know enough to just come in and say welcome and get them a cup of coffee if he judges them able to hold it. He'll get them aside and tip them off to be sure to pet Pat Montesian's dogs during the interview. They'll be sprawled all over the front office, sides heaving, writhing and biting at themselves. He'll tell them it's a proved fact
that if Pat's dogs like you, you're in. Pat Montesian has directed Gately to tell Appliers this, and then if